Hi everybody and welcome back to Stack Trace, the show that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. With me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John, but I do have a disclaimer to make.
Ooh, what is that?
My place is under renovations at the moment, and I have Yoshi recording with me, basically.
Oh, so we have a special guest on this episode.
Yeah, I guess so. So if there are any weird noises in the background during this episode, I apologize. That's why.
Either barks or power drills.
Right. And how are you?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. I've been battling with some weird mystery illness for a little while now. Nothing serious, so don't worry. And I did take a COVID test and it was negative, so that's all good. But I've been feeling a little bit, you know, how it is when you're a little bit ill and, you know, have some low energy. But of course, I still wanted to record Stack Trace. But if I do sound a little bit different, then that's why. But other than that, you know, excited to be here.
The show must go on.
Exactly. So, Rambo, besides getting your home renovated and taking care of your dog, what have you been up to lately?
So, I have been renovating something else. I've been renovating the Chibi Studio paywall, and I think we talked about this in a previous episode, how we were redesigning the paywall in Chibi Studio and doing some A/B testing and things like that. So now I would like to update you and our listeners on what happened after we did all of those tests.
All right, exciting. So could you recap a little bit what the tests were and then, of course, also share with us how everything went?
Right, so it was actually an ABC test.
All right.
So we had the traditional paywall, which was this super fancy animated paywall where you chose an item which belonged to a paid pack in Chibi Studio, and it would show you this whole full screen animation of the items in the pack with a description and the options to purchase the pack or to purchase the what we called back then the lifetime unlock, which would unlock everything. So that was the traditional, so the control basically. We had a second variation, which was a simple design. So instead of being all fancy and animated and having all of that content in the paywall, it was basically just an icon representing the pack, a short description, and a buy button. And that was it. And the regulatory, like, restart purchases and stuff like that. So that was the second variation. And the third one was a mix between a redesign and a business model change, if you will, because we decided to also test what would happen if instead of when you tapped a premium item, we instead of showing the actual pack product where you could get that particular item, we would just show the in-app purchase for the lifetime unlock. But instead of calling it Lifetime, we decided to call it Chibi Studio Plus.
Right. Yeah, as one almost has to these days, right? Name of product or name of company and then Plus.
Yeah, and we thought about, like, should it be Pro, Premium, Plus? And then we went with Plus, which is more familiar to people. And so that was... That would use the simplified design, pretty much the same simplified design, but then instead of offering that individual pack, it would offer the lifetime unlock. But instead of like showing a paywall for the lifetime unlock with information about the lifetime unlock, it's kind of like it displays information about the pack you chose an item for, but it offers the full unlock and then describes that you'll get that plus X other packs and all future releases as well. So those were the three tests.
Right. And none of these were subscriptions, right? Like they're still unlocks, but one unlocks everything, the plus product, while you can also unlock individual packs in the other tests, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you can still unlock individual packs even with that change because we do show them in another part of the app, but it's a more like advanced operation in that case. Most people end up in the paywall because they tapped a premium item. So yeah, we decided to do that test and we were a bit concerned about what you mentioned because Plus, these days is associated with subscriptions quite a bit, especially like with Apple's stuff being Plus most of the time, and then other apps have also adopted that. But we've since like subscriptions became a pretty much a norm on iOS, we make it very clear in the product page that it's a one-time purchase. And it was really tricky to choose the wording for that, because you tend to want to say like, this is not a subscription or something like that. But if the word subscription is in there and the person is allergic to subscriptions, they are going to see subscription. Oh no, I'm out of here.
Right.
So we chose to do the opposite and just say that it's a one-time purchase very clearly. And at the end of the day, I don't want to share like exact numbers, but the full unlock only option was the winner.
That's very cool. I'm guessing also that's very good for you business-wise, because that means that people are making a larger purchase instead of making a bunch of smaller ones, and therefore like converting into like the best kinds of customers that you can have, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we were optimizing for revenue in this case, of course, but we also didn't want people to have a bad experience. And in fact, we actually lowered the cost of this full unlock. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was close to $20 in the US, and it was almost like we cut it by almost half, basically, so that it would be less expensive for people to do that, and probably we would get more people buying it because it wasn't such a big purchase. Of course, I always said here that if you want to make more money, you should charge more. That's kind of obvious, but some people have the idea that if you charge less, you're going to make more money on the volume, but that's in reality really hard to achieve. But I think we had the perfect combination of numbers and circumstances where for us it made sense to do that, because that change combined with only offering by default this full unlock option made it so the increase in the number of sales of the full unlock made up for the difference where we're charging less for it right now.
Right. And it is definitely, I think, true what you're saying, that you can't always think that, you know, lowering the price means that you're going to sell more and therefore it's worth it. Of course, that's usually a very, very complicated equation that you have to make, right?
Right.
Where, you know, what do you optimize for volume or for individual purchases, and you charge more per customer. But there's another important variable here, I feel like, and you mentioned it just now, which is kind of simplicity, where if you have a lot of different options, I feel like that can sometimes act as a complicating factor where people have a hard time deciding which one to get, and maybe they don't get anything, or that it feels like, you know, oh, if I'm buying this pack now, then I have to buy another one, and I end up spending a lot of money, and then maybe they don't make any purchase at all, or maybe they just buy one and then not another. And if you just have this one simple option and it looks very good, like the value of that purchase seems very, very nice, then that can also act as a kind of boost. And it seems like your experiment here kind of showed that when you have that simplified business model, even though it might cost a bit more than those individual packs, more people went for it because, well, maybe it was just simpler and easier and just felt more appealing.
Right, exactly. And that's what the idea was behind the whole thing, is we realized that in trying to offer options and trying so hard to convince people that it was so cool that they could purchase this content and look at this content, it's so great, we actually made the UI itself so complicated. It wasn't actually complicated, but it was too visually complex to navigate, where there were so many places for the user to get lost within and not make the purchase. So for that particular part of your app, the paywall, you want to have that very clear call to action and have that be like the easiest thing for the user to do if you want them to actually do the purchase. If you have 3, 4, 5 different buttons they can press in that screen, they're gonna end up lost and not buying anything in the end. So I think your paywall should ideally be very simple, and like there should be this very big get it now, buy or whatever call to action button, and the small little restore purchases button, and a button to close the paywall, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. You should definitely try to minimize the amount of friction, right? In these kind of critical flows in your app. And I think the same thing is also true for other kind of funnel-based interactions, if you will, such as sign-up flows. And in fact, that's something I've been working on recently. I've been working on a new sign-up flow for a client. And there was also kind of funny where we started off with these kind of more complicated designs with lots of information. And, you know, we wanted to make it nice and feel welcoming when you first install the app and you want to log in. But then we realized after testing it for a little bit that actually, if we simplify this and remove a lot of these UI elements, it will feel more streamlined and easier. And, you know, I'm just entering my email and then I'm getting this and then I'm doing that. And then, whoops, I'm into the app, right? And that kind of feeling when you feel like it's very smooth and there's nothing kind of standing in your way, that can sometimes be kind of a little bit counterintuitive as a developer or designer, where you feel like, you know, if I add more information here, and like you said, if I try to really convince the user that they should buy this product or sign up for the app, and, you know, it's going to be so simple, it's going to be so nice, that can actually just make things worse for the user because it just seems more complicated. And something more streamlined and simple and really polished as well, that feels fast and fluid to go through, can really yield like a hugely amount of better results, right? And that's something that I find very fascinating when working with these things, especially when you're working at a larger scale, when you just see like the slightest little tweak to a button size or placement of a button can, you know, result in thousands of users dropping off or actually signing up or completing a purchase. Like, it's really interesting how it works that way.
Yeah, famously, I think Google actually did A/B testing even on the different shades of a given color for a button to check what would work best. And when you are at that scale, it actually makes sense to do that sort of testing. Not in our scale, but it's funny because I worked at an e-commerce company before in an iOS app, and we went through this stuff as well, like different funnels, as you mentioned, and how different design decisions and even sometimes implementation decisions would affect conversion. And it's easy to think as an indie developer that, oh, I don't need to care about that stuff, I'm not a big company. But that stuff actually matters. That's why so many big companies do look at those numbers and do try to optimize for that stuff. Of course, you can go too far in that direction, and then like everything is driven by revenue and numbers and engagement. I really don't like that word. So everything becomes driven by that. And I don't think you want that as an indie developer or even as a company, because the end result can sometimes not be the best for the user. But for these specific situations, I think it makes sense to think a little bit about that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's an important counterweight to have when you're talking about these kind of more like data-driven decisions and using A/B testing and things like that to inform your decisions when you're working on these kind of UIs. And that counterweight, I feel like, is taste or design or aesthetics, whatever you want to call it, where if you optimize a UI too much, it can just end up feeling kind of screaming at you, very ugly, just like lots of just too high contrast green buttons that are flashing, because that's actually what humans tend to draw their attention towards, right? But it might just not look very good at all. And I think that's also incredibly important, especially if you're trying to build a brand where, you know, you want to have something that feels like it has a lot of quality and craftsmanship involved in building it, and, you know, it's a nice user experience. Then you also, I feel like, have to balance all of those kind of engagement metrics against, you know, having a nice and welcoming and calming design that doesn't just optimize everything for, you know, performing purchases and signing up as many users as possible.
Yeah, it's a really tricky balance, like you mentioned. You want to be annoying enough to the point where enough people will see the paywall and possibly purchase something, but you don't want to be so annoying that people will just be frustrated and quit the app.
Exactly, because if you think about it, the very best user experience, if you would just optimize for user experience, would just be to make everything free, right? That would be the best user experience. You would just get everything you wanted all for free all the time. But unfortunately, that's not how, you know, you can build a sustainable business, at least for most people. So yeah, you definitely need that balance.
Yeah, you say that, but we actually get so many app reviews of the app in the App Store. Like, everything should be free.
Yeah, it's funny, right? How it feels like, you know, there are certain people who just feel like all software should be free and that they don't see kind of the value in software. And, at you know, to some extent, I kind of understand that because not everyone knows kind of what goes into actually building an app.
Right.
And it might feel to them that, you know, this was something that they, you know, someone built in half an hour or something, while the truth is that you've been spending, you know, years and years kind of maintaining and building this app. And if you would actually explain that to them, I'm sure they would change their mind. But of course, that's something that you can't really do.
Right.
So that perception, you know, that software should be free. And especially since, you know, in the modern age with the web and everything, a lot of software is free, right?
Right.
And that, I feel like, is a bit going to be a kind of a never-ending battle, especially for indie developers, where it's like, this is my kind of boutique bespoke software that I created, right? Like, this is worth paying for. And that's something that you're always going to have a hard time convincing certain people that, you know, it is worth paying for any kind of software.
Yeah, exactly.
But Rambo, now I do actually want to tell you and our listeners about something that is actually free, and that's this episode's sponsor.
Nice.
So let's take a very quick break here to thank this episode's sponsor, which is Essential Developer. Now, something that both Rambo and I get asked very often is, how can you level up your skills as a developer to reach a more senior position? And while there are a ton of code-level resources out there, from Stack Overflow to tutorial websites to blogs and articles like mine, finding a place that will teach you all of the skills that are required to become more senior can be really, really tricky. That's why Rambo and I are so excited to help promote Essential Developer, because they do just that. They've got a completely free course called the iOS Architect Crash Course, which is all about helping mid-level developers from around the world take that step to become complete senior developers. They will teach you hands-on how to refactor and maintain code over time, how to avoid common anti-patterns, how to utilize concepts like composition, how to design architectures, and much more. The course is held 100% online, so you can attend it from anywhere around the world. And it's free. So if this course sounds interesting to you, then I really recommend checking it out at essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace. And we'll leave that link in the show notes as well. But don't wait too long, because this course is only available at limited times. So simply head over to essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace to check out this course and to sign up for free. Thanks a lot to Essential Developer for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace.
So, John, what have you been up to?
So I've been working on a bunch of different things, and one of the things I've been working on is reducing UI flickering in one project.
Ooh.
And that's something that I thought would be an interesting topic for today. And it's interesting because, you know, when we're working with iOS apps or any kind of UI-driven apps in general, you can have many different sources of, glitching or, you know, reduced performance or things that can kind of become a little bit annoying to users, even if they're not bugs where, you know, the app is crashing or you're prevented from performing some action or something like that. It just, you know, doesn't feel as polished as it could be. And when it comes to kind of classic performance problems, such as, let's say you're in a scroll view and you're scrolling and then you're calling some function from the main thread that is a little bit heavy and it ends up actually taking longer than what you have time for when it comes to drawing the next frame, you can end up with kind of stuttering and dropping frames in that scrolling motion. And that can end up just feeling, you know, laggy and, yeah, stuttery, not that great. Like, the scrolling is not as fluid as it should be. And of course, there are many other sources of performance issues you can have. But when we're in that kind of scrolling context, that's where most of those issues will pop up, I would say, especially in something like iOS apps. But in general, I would say these days that these kind of classic performance issues, they are less and less common. If I look at the most apps that I use on my phone, I would say most of them scroll pretty smoothly and everything is in general pretty smooth. And I would say that's both because the optimizations that Apple have made to all of the UI frameworks when it comes specifically to things like scrolling and, you know, table views and cell reuse and those sorts of things, but also that the CPUs and GPUs in our phones have become so incredibly fast, right?
Right.
I remember like back in the day when we were dealing with like the iPhone 3G or, you know, the iPhone 4 or something, that we always really had to be careful about like avoiding blending, for example, in scroll views and, you know, avoiding using too many shadows because that could result in poor scrolling performance. Like those things are not generally issues today, even though I would still argue that it's good to optimize those things because, well, the more kind of CPU and GPU resources you use, even if you will maintain your frame rate, you will just consume more battery life, right?
Right.
And so in general, I would say it's still good to run your app through, you know, the profiler, make sure that, you know, you're not consuming too many resources, making sure you optimize like those kind of hot code paths that might like just be slow, or you know, you might need to introduce some caching if there's a bunch of operations that are repeated that could be, the results could be saved and so on. But what I'm talking about here is more kind of flickering, where you're not necessarily having poor performance, but just because of the way something was implemented, it leads to a user experience that feels a little bit glitchy. And one very common example of this is if you are in an app navigating to a new screen, and while you are navigating to that screen, you are starting to load the data for that screen. And sometimes that data might take, let's say, half a second to load. Sometimes it might take a full second or longer to load. But sometimes the result might be cached or, you know, take really, really quickly to load for some other reasons. And then you might end up like just as you navigate to that screen, the content just pops in.
Right.
Or you might be showing like a loading spinner for like, let's say, 2 frames or like a few milliseconds, and then the content pops in. And this is what I would say is a flicker. It looks like a flicker to the user, where it looks like, you know, the content of the screen, like what's rendered on the screen, is just flickering. And this can end up being even worse if you're in something like a search UI, where if you are, for example, typing a new character, and as you're doing that, the previous results are cleared, and you might be, again, showing a loading spinner while the search is performed, and then the search ends up just taking like 50 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, then you can end up just like seeing that loading spinner flicker in and out of view as soon as you type any character, right?
Right.
And then on top of that, you have things like asynchronous image fetching, which can also suffer from the same problem, where a lot of apps, what they will do is that they will show like a placeholder image while you're loading an image, but you can end up showing that placeholder also just for like, let's say 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, and then the image comes back in and that also looks like a flicker, especially again, if you're like searching, let's say you're typing like a filter or something into a table view, and then the cells that you see, like the results you see, will update really quickly, and then all the images will just load for every new cell, and then you will end up seeing those placeholders flickering in and out of view, as also the loading spinner is doing. So all of this can really add up to a user experience that it really feels very flickery, it feels very unstable, and even though there's nothing wrong with the performance, like the app is performing as intended, it's not consuming excess battery life, it's actually kind of too fast, right? That's
right.
Actually kind of what's happening, is that these operations that are asynchronous, they end up being too fast, and therefore it just looks unstable. Like it would look better if it was slower, if it would take like 1 second to load every image, then it would give the UI a more stable look and feel. But that's not the case in this kind of scenario. And I'm sure, Rambo, this is something that you've also been experiencing and had to fix in a lot of projects as well, right?
Oh, this is a topic I'm incredibly passionate about because I see this so many times. And of course, I am not immune to this sort of thing. You can probably find lots of instances of these issues in my apps. But my pet peeve, I think, is the millisecond loading spinner.
And yeah, that's a classic one.
Yeah, and I talked about this recently in another podcast, and I fixed this in different ways in different projects. Back at the e-commerce company, at the Jobby Job, I remember I did something where when you tapped an item in the app's home screen on a list, it would actually delay doing the push of the new view controller in the navigation controller, and it would try to prefetch the content before doing the push. and it would only do the push and show a loading spinner if it took longer than, say, 200 milliseconds. I don't remember. It was a very small delay because, of course, if you're tapping something, there's only so much delay the user is willing to not perceive as a delay, basically. On scrolling lists, on iOS, by default, there's already a little bit of a delay for every tap, but it's very small. So what I was doing was something like that. I had an abstraction. I don't know if it was like something like deferred navigation controller or something like that. And it would do a very small delay because oftentimes, if you were on a good internet connection, you would get the data for that new view controller in like less than 100 milliseconds sometimes. So it really didn't make sense to do the push of the view controller, show a loading spinner for less than like 50 milliseconds, and then like flash the content on screen. It looked glitchy. And just by doing that tiny little change of doing the prefetching and the push and using as a fallback, so if it took longer than a predefined delay, of course, the user wouldn't be staring at the unresponsive home screen of the app for 2 seconds or something. No, it would, after that timeout, it would just push the new view controller and fall back to the loading spinner. But then the loading spinner was guaranteed to be on screen for at least like half a second or 1 second, which doesn't look like a glitch anymore. But in most circumstances, with a good internet connection, the experience was that there was no loading at all. Like the perceived experience is that the app doesn't load anything, even though it was loading stuff.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned those techniques there, because that's also some of my go-to techniques for fixing these types of issues. And it's so interesting to me, because what we're essentially doing here is that we're adding delays.
Right.
But by adding delays, we're making our UI feel faster. It's kind of counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
And because it's all about the perceived fastness or perceived fluidity of the UI, right? And those 200 milliseconds or whatever threshold you come up with, that is like, if you come up with a good threshold there, you're kind of hitting a nice balance between it not feeling like a delay, it's barely perceivable, but also you have enough time to complete that fetch. And especially if you're doing something like a cache fetch locally, then that will be really, really fast usually, even though it might be an asynchronous call. Or if you are just have a fast server, and usually in most cases, like you mentioned, it will be under that threshold. And then, like you said, it all of a sudden feels like this app is super fast because there's no loading screens at all, right? It's kind of like in game development where they will hide loading screens. Like instead of showing loading screens all the time, they just add these like doors you have to crawl under, right?
Right.
And that is a loading screen, but it doesn't feel like it because, well, you're interacting with the game as data is being loaded. And this is kind of the same thing here. You're interacting with the app. You're not stopping your interaction. You're not being stopped by a loading spinner wall. Instead, you are just like waiting for a super tiny amount of time, and then immediately you see your content. One important aspect to point out here, though, is that if you're doing this kind of technique, I would seriously recommend to still make sure that the cell is like properly highlighted immediately, right? So you don't delay those kinds of things, because you want the touches to feel still 100% immediate as they can be. And then, you know, even though you might be adding that delay for the actual navigation, and then you can add a bunch of things, like you mentioned, you can make sure the loading spinner always stays on screen at a certain amount of time. Another thing you could do is if you have a cache, you could add a separate code path for checking your cache. In fact, that's one of the ways I solved the image flickering issue that I mentioned earlier, which was that the image loading code was written using async await in this particular project. And that meant that even if we were loading an image from cache, that was done in an asynchronous task. And that meant that it would always come back on the next run loop, even if it would come directly from the cache, right?
Right.
And that meant that there would always be that one frame of flicker, even if the image was cached locally. And so what I just did was something that perhaps feels a little bit like a leaky abstraction, because it's so nice to have that API, which is just like get image from URL and then that's it, right? You don't have to worry if it's cached or not. But I just added a specific non-asynchronous function, like a completely synchronous function for checking if an image exists in the cache for a specific URL. And then I could get that completely synchronously and then you know, assign that to the image view and that's it, and then completely get rid of that flicker. And the same thing can be done in the navigation view context as well, where you could check, like, if the data is already preloaded, then you could just immediately navigate without adding any kind of delay. And then you kind of add the best of both worlds there, where you can have that small amount of delay for asynchronous calls while still doing that navigation immediately if the data is already available. And of course, this is something, like you also mentioned, you can wrap that up in a nice abstraction where you can use like a generic or something to say, like, this is a loadable protocol or something. And then, you know, you perform the load and you can have a function there as well for checking if it's already cached. And then you could have your data loader or view model or whatever conform to that protocol and then just pass that into that navigation link or navigation controller, whatever you want to call it. And then, you know, that does everything for you. So don't have to repeat this kind of code all of the time. And that also means that you can fine tune it and then apply that everywhere across your app, which is usually, you know, can lead to a really neat solution, I think.
Right, exactly. And the way I like to call this feeling, and you did mention fluidity. So in order to avoid the irony of having delays making the app feel faster, I like to say that they make the app feel more fluid.
Right.
Because it's objectively not faster. It can be actually slower sometimes in absolute terms, but the experience you get when you use the app is that it's more fluid. You don't feel like the app is holding you back, and you don't feel like things are getting in your way or there are these small glitches and delays, which we are software developers and we have like a sense for design and animation and things like that. So we do pay a lot of attention to that sort of thing. But even users who do not know anything about that stuff and don't pay attention to that stuff, they do feel it. You can ask the user and they'll say that such and such app feels better to use than another app, and they won't be able to put a finger on why exactly. And sometimes when you go look at the reason behind that, it will be because of this fluidity that you mentioned.
Exactly. And we were just talking about how important things like this are when it comes to onboarding and purchase flows and so on, where if something doesn't feel completely fluid, it can actually make customers not decide to purchase something, right? Especially right. When you're at a certain scale and so on. So I do think these things are really important. I mean, personally, I feel like they're important for kind of craftsmanship, if you want, or you know, taking pride in your work or making sure that your, you know, work is really, really good and polished, right? Of course,
right.
This is not something that I'm doing always, like this kind of work in like the first phase of a project, especially when you have a limited amount of hours, which I usually do when I work as a freelancer. Sometimes, you know, you need to just get something out of the door and then you can polish it, right? You want to make sure something is working really well and has good quality before you ship it, of course. But then afterwards, you can add these kinds of, you know, polish that just makes things even nicer. But I do still always feel like it's important to do this kind of work, you know, eventually, even if it might not be in the 1.0, but, you know, eventually, because, you know, like we talked about, usually you can find some kind of abstraction you can introduce into a project that you can reuse. It doesn't have to be like you have to go through the entire app and add these kinds of logic everywhere, but it can be something you can build like a little abstraction. You can maybe integrate into your kind of data loading pipeline if you have one. And that can be it, right? And
right.
Like we also talked about, like these tiny tweaks, which is just all about, you know, deciding when to show what, like that can make a huge difference. So yeah, definitely recommend doing this kind of work if you have any kind of flickering in the UIs that you work on.
Just be careful about cancellation, because if you do like the thing I mentioned with the tapping and navigating, and then the person taps on something else before the thing has loaded within that small delay, things can break terribly. So be careful about that.
Yeah, and memory management becomes really important as well, right? Especially if you're starting to introduce a lot of caching and so on, you definitely want to make sure that, you know, you're not just adding a ton of memory usage to reduce flickering.
Right.
And, you know, be careful about that as well, of course. And yeah, absolutely. Like you said, like you definitely need to make sure that tasks are not just kept running in the background for prefetching, especially if you do like actual prefetching, which might be to, you know, if the user is when they scroll down in this product page, they are very likely, we've seen in our analytics that like 90% of users tap on the like related products button. So let's just prefetch that, right? That right. might be a smart move because that can, again, make your app feel more fluid. But then if the user dismisses that product screen, then it's very important to remember to cancel that task, right? So don't you end up loading related products for many screens that are not even in use anymore.
Exactly.
In fact, cancellation is like a really important topic also in this sense when it comes to things like search also, where, you know, when you're performing a search, it's very, very common to want to add also some kind of debouncing where you don't necessarily want to start a new search operation every single time the user presses a character immediately, because then if you cancel the previous one and the user types really quickly, then that can just, you know, end up causing a lot of unnecessary search operations. And it, related to that also is that if you have then those pending search operations that might come back later, those might be for results that the user that are no longer relevant because the user has just typed more characters. So that's another kind of delay to keep in mind as well. It's kind of different, right? Because
right.
that is a delay that you start loading a bit later. What we're talking about here is more like the UI updates themselves. And especially I would say if you are doing debouncing, that can also lead to more flickering, because if you're doing an implementation where you're clearing out the search results as soon as the query changes, so the user will see an empty view, and then you do debouncing, and then you load the data, and then you show it, then that can also end up looking like flickering because, well, you showed an empty screen there for the duration of the debounce, which might be like, let's say, 100 milliseconds or something. And that's where, in many cases, you might want to still show the old search results even as the query changes, and then, again, use like a threshold to say, well, if the search takes longer than, let's say, you know, 200-300 milliseconds, then I clear the previous search results and show a loading spinner. But if it happens quicker than that, then I'll just keep the old search results in view. And then when the new one comes in, I just replace them immediately. And then that, again, can look a lot more stable and, you know, really reduce flickering because you're just replacing one set of results directly with another one without going through an empty screen.
Right. And just to top it all off, another type of glitch that I see quite often and is usually easier to work around. I say usually, but that's almost like saying just. is unintentional animation. And I think, especially in Swift UI, that can become quite easy to have that happen. So always be mindful of that when you decide to animate something. Because sometimes you do want to animate something, but not in every context. So maybe you want to animate an update to a list view, but you don't want to animate the first update. So like as you are navigating to that screen or something. So that's something I see quite often where you have an unintentional animation happening and that usually looks weird, glitchy, and can actually make the app feel slower.
Exactly. And this is again where you might want to use like a timer or use time as a deciding factor, where sometimes what I will do is I will track how long a given request took to make. And then when it comes back, I check that timer and I see, okay, it took like 700 milliseconds to load this data. Then I'm actually going to apply a fade in to the content, for example, because that right. will look nice. It took almost a second to load. Then I'm going to fade it in for, let's say, you know, 300 milliseconds or something. And that's going to look really nice and fluid, right? But if it took like, again, 200, 300, 400, something like that, like it was much faster, I might do a quicker fade in or no fade in at all. And then again, that might look more fluid because, well, it just less kind of things happening and less kind of a fade in effects and so on when the user barely perceived that there was any loading going on at all. So time is your friend when it comes to avoiding glitches.
Exactly.
All right. But I think it's time now to wrap up this episode of Stack Trace. So this was a little bit of a shorter episode today. We will have another episode very soon, actually, towards the end of May, where we're going to do our regular poker episode, where we're going to predict what Apple might introduce at WWDC. And of course, this year, I feel like the game is going to be especially interesting, Rambo, because we have so many rumors, especially around all the AR, VR stuff. Again, the story that just keeps coming back. So stay tuned for that episode, which is coming up in just a few weeks towards the end of May. We'll have that in your podcast player of choice. But until then, thanks so much for listening to this episode of Stacktrace. Thanks also so much to Essential Developer for sponsoring this episode. Make sure to check them out using the link that is in the show notes. But that's it for this time. So talk to you soon and say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.